Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the opioid crisis has impacted families and communities in many ways. We'll find out how it may be affecting the homicide rate in Milwaukee. First, record low temperatures have gripped most of the country and has already been blamed for multiple deaths. The National Weather Service issued warnings for areas between South Texas and Canada and from Montana to New England. Here in Wisconsin, authorities say three people in the Madison area, two in Milwaukee, and one near Lake Winnebago have died because of the cold weather. Jonathan Martin is a professor of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department at UW-Madison. He's also a regular on the Larry Mueller Show, and he's here to tell us what is behind this bitter cold snap. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, same to you, Judith. Nice to be here.
So, Jonathan, in a nutshell, why are we seeing such cold temperatures for such extended time?
Well, what really underlies it is any cold snap is, of course, it gets colder the further north one goes in the northern hemisphere in the wintertime because the sun is now down at the North Pole and latitudes immediately surrounding the North Pole for 6 months. So the ground just continues, the air above the ground continues to cool radiatively over, you know, several weeks, several months period of time, and it gets progressively colder. What has to happen is for the weather patterns of the flow patterns in the middle and upper troposphere to orient themselves in such a way that we have strong flow from the north straight down into the central part of North America. When that's the case, at this time of year, it's impossible to escape a prolonged cold snap because the air that's coming towards us is very, very cold. It's coming out of the factory of cold air production at the high latitudes in the poles.
So, of course, here in the Midwest, we do see cold temperatures in the winter. That's just part of life. But how unusual are these temperatures that we've been seeing the last week or so?
Well, these are pretty unusual. One can look at a bunch of different ways in which record temperatures are set. They can either be set for the calendar day, they can be set for the month in which they occur, or they can be all-time highs or lows. And so those are over a period of years. So we've had quite a number of across the country. We've had about 965 daily low temperature records, so low minimum temperatures, set over the last 7 or 8 days. And we've had about 435 overnight minimum temperatures, low minimum temperatures set 4 calendar days over that period of time as well. So there's quite a number of unusually cold December 24th through December 28th across the country, centered in the central part of the United States, especially the northern plain states. There's only been 2 all-time minimum temperature records set in that entire period, although one of them was in Wisconsin. The town of Winter, Wisconsin, broke its all-time minimum of minus 22. That's as cold as it's ever been in that town, and that broke the minimum that was set on January 17, 1982, the prior one, by 1 degree. So we haven't had a lot of all-time minimum temperature records, but we've had a lot of daily minimum temperature records, and that's still significant.
And how far off are we from what would be normal or expected weather for this time of year, say, in the upper Midwest?
Yeah, we're way off from that. So we're running about 20 or so degrees below normal each day.
Wow.
The average temperature for a day at this time of year is around 20 Fahrenheit, adding the daytime high and the daytime minimum together and dividing by 2. And we're not even barely getting to about 0 when we do that the last couple of days, especially yesterday. I think we probably had an average that was a little bit below 0 when you add the maximum and the minimum. So we're running way below. And that's been the case since about the day before Christmas, with a little bit of variation around a minus 15 to a minus 20 degree departure per day. So we've really, it's been an extended cold snap for sure.
And is that similar in usually warmer parts of the country that are also getting part of this cold wave? Are they that much below their normal temperatures as well?
That is a good question. Off the top of my head, I'm not certain of that. But I wouldn't be surprised because at other levels, just above the surface level of the earth, over parts of central and eastern United States, the temperatures are well below normal at that level, which makes me think that they're well below normal, even at the surface themselves. I don't know if it's as much as 20, but it could be.
We're talking with Jonathan Martin. He's a professor in the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department at UW-Madison, talking about this really incredible cold snap that we are in. Now, Jonathan, we hear a lot about wind chill. So we hear the real temperatures and then the wind chill.
Yeah.
First of all, how is wind chill calculated?
It's calculated based on a laboratory-derived formula that involves reference both to the air temperature itself, the still air temperature itself, as well as the wind speed. And it's what do they call them? They call them empirical formulas. So it's based upon trying to estimate how cold it feels, how cold moving air feels were that air still. So when you get a reported wind chill temperature of minus 30, what that means is the current combination of temperature and wind makes exposed skin feel as if the air surrounding it were still but at minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So it gives you an idea of how fast you might lose that skin to frostbite.
And so is it just how it feels, or does it actually, does a strong wind on a cold day actually make it more dangerous to be out in it?
Yes, it really does. I mean, it's actually an equivalence for what you would feel if the air were still. So it's a real threat. When somebody tells you the wind chill is minus 35, that means that you're putting your skin, exposed skin, into an environment that would be the same as the temperature being minus 35, and you will lose heat at an extraordinarily fast rate. And in fact, at that level, I think Madison School Department correctly makes the judgment that if that's the case, you shouldn't even be outside waiting for the bus, because you're going to lose some part of your skin to frostbite if you're not excessively careful, and little kids can't be as excessively careful.
So some people, including President Trump, have cast doubt on climate change, given the unusually cold temperatures that we've been seeing. How do you respond to that correlation being made?
Well, there's two things that can be said right off the top of my head on that. One of them is all one has to do is investigate the data and realize that though it is cold in the central United States right now and in the eastern United States, there's no doubt about that. And that's a feature worth reckoning. But around the hemisphere, we have just finished our 17th warmest December out of the last 70 Decembers. So we're nowhere near anything that's unusually cold hemispherically. Mm. And in fact, that 17th out of the last 70, I think there are about 11 of the 17 top warmest Decembers occurred since the year 2000. So we're definitely in an environment, our global environment, that is warming. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to get cold days or periods of cold days, cold snaps like the one we've had. But it just means they're going to become less frequent and less severe. And that even that's true. We only had two all-time minimum temperature records broken with this cold snap. And that's probably, had you put it 50 years ago, we would have probably had more like 10 to 15 all-time minimums shattered by this cold. So you're seeing the effect of warming around the hemisphere. You don't necessarily see it every day in your backyard.
So basically, it sounds like you're saying, John, that localized or shorter-term weather patterns aren't necessarily the data to look at when you're looking at these large changes like climate change.
No, one has to imagine the long integral of those. You know, look at 50 winters, look at 50 December 28ths, and see what the average is turning into over that period of time, as opposed to what just this one is. That's exactly right. The danger of parochialism trumping what we view as a large-scale climate signal is increased, unfortunately, in the current administration. They seem to believe that this kind of a cold snap is evidence that there's no global warming. It's not. It has nothing to do with that. They're separate issues.
John, do you have a sense of what the rest of the winter might look like? Do we have more, either continuing this cold snap or other cold snaps coming in the future, or might we get back to more normal temperatures?
Well, I suppose that it's hard to imagine that we stay in such an unusual weather pattern that gives us unusual cold for an extended period of time. These kind of things have lifespans. We don't really understand how the atmosphere will evolve throughout the rest of the winter. We can't predict it the way we can predict the weather in the next two or three days. It's a very different problem. But there are indications that with a cooler than normal Pacific sea surface temperature near the equator, that we don't have any particular forcing to give us an unusually warm rest of the winter. I could say that. The chances of that being the case are fairly small, at least from what we understand about how the global circulation sometimes conspires to give us an unusually warm winter. No such forcings are in action right now. So I guess even if we end up being normal for the rest of the winter, this snap right here will remind people of the winter 2017-18 being rather bitter. It'll have to turn and become exceptionally warm before people forget about this. I don't anticipate that happening.
Is there any relationship between how cold or not a winter is and how much snow precipitation we get?
Yeah, there is. That's a really good question. I think at the beginning of this cold snap, the day or two before Christmas, we had a couple of cold nights. Had we had measurable snow on the ground, an inch, maybe 2 inches of snow or more, I think those first few nights would have been even colder, so that the length and severity of the particular snap we're in right now would have probably felt worse than it actually has. So now that we ended up with that kind of creeping 2 inches of snow around New Year's Day that fell and kind of still persists, that's helping to really cool us off overnight, and then give us a difficult time starting to warm up during the next sunny day like today. It's hot. The temperature's struggling to rise. Had we had snow on the 22nd, 23rd of December, we would have had an even longer period of misery, I think, out of this. So it makes a big difference.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us and bringing us up to speed on this unusual and bitter cold snap.
Yeah, you bet, Judith. Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Martin is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. He's also a regular on the Larry Mueller Show as half of the Weather Guys on the last Monday of each month. He joined us today to look at the record-breaking freezing temperatures around the country. Right now, Milwaukee homicides spiked in 2015 and again in 2016, following a trend with cities across the country. Now, a new federal study indicates that the opioid crisis was a key player in that increase. Ashley Luthern reported on the study. She's a public safety reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what have been the general trends in Milwaukee homicides over the past few years?
So Milwaukee saw a really sharp increase in homicides from 2014 to 2015. It kind of stayed about the same level in 2016 as 15, so higher than usual. This year, at the end of 2017, we had a lower homicide total than those other years, but it's still higher than the long-term averages at the beginning of this decade.
And do we know why there has been such an increase and a sustained increase in homicides in Milwaukee?
So there are a lot of different theories that have come to the forefront when discussing the spike in Milwaukee and in other cities. I think a lot of people rightfully point to root causes as the true underlying factors in deadly violence, whether it's poverty, educational opportunities, employment, the sort of deep systemic factors. But one thing that we know is that those factors did not suddenly change from 2014 to 2015. They've been persistent. They're long term. What did change? A lot of people have pointed to tensions between the African American communities and police as a possible contributing factor after these high profile police uses of force. Another factor that has been gaining more and more coverage lately is the opioid crisis. A lot of criminologists and people who study this say that what you're really starting to see is the opioid crisis hitting the criminal justice system in a different way.
And a federal study actually just pointed to that. What prompted that study in the first place to look at the connection between opioids and murder?
So the study was actually the second on the subject of the huge spike in Milwaukee and other cities such as St. Louis, Chicago, when examining the rise in homicides. And so it was examining factors that people suggested might play a role. And they definitely did find that opioids are playing a larger role than maybe initially believed. And part of the reason for the time gap is you need time to, number one, solve these cases. You can only really identify underlying factors if you are able to gather information about a case. And so, there are still a large number of cases that there's not a definitive understanding for why it took place because it's not solved. But for those that have been solved, conflicts over drug sales or drug-related robberies have really increased in Milwaukee. And so this study was looking at what people have suggested played a role in these spikes in homicides in certain cities in the country.
You mentioned some other Midwestern cities where they were also looking at this connection. Is this also a trend in other parts of the country?
Yes. I mean, the researchers were looking at the national statistics maintained by the FBI, and so they were looking. One interesting data point that they looked at was the number of white homicide victims and suspects, which also rose. So as one of the researchers who I interviewed pointed out, it's notable because the dominant narrative has focused on tensions between the African-American community and police, and that doesn't the fact that white victimization and white suspects rose in that time period doesn't really fit that narrative very easily. And in Milwaukee, we did see that in 2016 with white victims representing 12% of all homicide victims compared to only 6% the year before.
And why would there be a rise in both white victims and perpetrators when crimes are specifically closely linked to opioid use?
Well, this researcher is positing that this is because you're seeing a lot of opioid usage in the white community, and that this is a correlating factor that indicates perhaps opioids then are, it's another piece of evidence that suggests that opioids are playing a larger role in violence.
So is this new? It seems like for decades, politicians have linked drugs to violent crimes. Even, you know, going back to the 80s, there were these huge campaigns about drug-related crime. Is this new or is this just a new chapter?
I think it's a new chapter. And I think particularly if we're talking about Milwaukee specifically, we are fortunate in that we have pretty good data, thanks to the Milwaukee Police Department and the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission, that has studied these homicides and non-fatal shootings, and they do find that, you know, still arguments and fights are a leading primary factor of deadly violence in the city. However, the nature of the drug trade has changed, and so I think, you know, you used to see things like turf battles over corners and houses fought by structured gangs, and those have been replaced by these rolling drug houses and crews or loose groups of friends who don't have formal affiliations. And because of that, it might be harder to see a little bit of a pattern right away linking the drug trade to this violence. And of course, I know it sounds obvious, I'm sure, to many of your listeners, that violence goes along with drugs. That is true. I think now this is just a study being able to put some research towards that. I mean, anytime you have something that's very valuable, very profitable, such as, you know, drugs or the individuals carrying those goods or carrying the cash from those drug sales, that's going to be a target for robbery or other violence.
We're talking with Ashley Luther, and she's a public safety reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're taking a look at the connection between the opioid epidemic and Milwaukee homicide rates. And Ashley, you talked with Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, and he thought that the Ferguson effect was a larger factor than the opioid epidemic in these rises in murder rates. Tell us first what the Ferguson effect is.
So this theory has two interpretations, and this is something that's been discussed and hotly debated throughout the nation, honestly. The theory has two kind of interpretations. The first is that a series of high-profile police shootings nationwide and protests resulted in depolicing, meaning officers backed off, made fewer traffic stops and arrests, were less likely to be proactive. The second is that those same high-profile incidents further eroded police legitimacy in minority neighborhoods, making people less likely to trust the criminal justice system and cooperate with it. And when you have that lack of legitimacy, that could lead to furtherance of violence. Maybe people, police aren't able to solve cases without community input, therefore making it more likely that more cases will lead to retaliation or ongoing feuds because they're not making these arrests and putting a stop to it earlier. And so the researcher of this most recent study that we've been talking about, he said that he didn't have much evidence at this point for police withdrawal as a primary factor. Arrest rates, which is one measure of police activity, already had been declining before 2015, before these things, before a lot of these high-profile incidents sort of dominated the national conversation on policing. And then he said, for the other side, trying to measure legitimacy, it's certainly plausible, but the problem is you're trying to measure changes in beliefs and values, and that's really difficult without systemic surveys.
Is this federal study definitive? Do we now know that there is this direct connection between the opioid epidemic and Milwaukee homicide rates, or does more research need to be done?
So I think, like pretty much any academic study, the researchers come to the conclusion that more research needs to be done. And, they aren't being flip when they say that. There's just a lot that we don't know, a lot of what we're able to say about previous crime trends that only came years after the fact, years after being able to study what was happening in the aftermath of it, and also what led up to it. And so I think, the primary researcher in this academic study and others such as Mallory O'Brien, who leads the Homicide Review Commission here, both said that more study will be needed with particular focus on neighborhoods and blocks within cities where this violence is concentrated, because I think that's an important thing to remember, is that a lot of violence happens in very concentrated areas. It's a very localized issue and, of course, has broad concerns for the entire community, the entire city and state, but that it is a very localized issue.
Certainly, we have not seen any signs of the opioid crisis slowing down or being resolved. But Milwaukee homicides, as you noted, Ashley, have decreased at least slightly in 2016 and 2017. Is there any theory as to why there might have been that at least a slight dip in the last couple of years?
I think the dip between 2015 and 2016 is pretty negligible. If you would ask researchers about that, it was a difference of a few homicides. There was a pretty significant decrease in 2017, and I think some of it might just be pure. Some have suggested that is just pure kind of a return to the average, if you will, of what we've seen historically in terms of our homicide rates here in Milwaukee. I think there are some others. There's been some specific initiatives within the police department that I'm sure they would point to as being pretty effective. One of them was the Center Street Corridor Project, which was done with federal partners, and they were able to lower non-fatal shootings. They've made a concentrated area and targeting a small section of the city that generates about 10% of all violent crime in the city. And then I think you're seeing a lot of, you're seeing a lot of residents getting involved. You're seeing more block watches being created. You're seeing more efforts on that front. So I think it's a combination of all of those things.
Well, Ashley, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Lutheran is a public safety reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She reported on a federal study that links the opioid crisis to a 2015 jump in homicides in Milwaukee. First, the most common New Year's resolutions are health-related. People often have goals like lose weight, exercise more, or eat healthier. But when it comes to big lifestyle changes, it's hard to know where to start. And if you can't afford certain produce or pricey grocery stores and food services, meeting those health goals can be tough. Claude Tellis is the CEO of NatureAid, which makes Vegan Smart, a vegan nutritional protein powder. His work has also focused on healthy eating in underprivileged communities and fighting childhood obesity. He successfully campaigned to fill vending machines in the LA school system with wholesome snacks. Claude, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks for joining us. So, Claude, what would you say some of the biggest barriers are to healthy eating and healthy lifestyles for underprivileged communities?
I think the first and number one is education. People really don't know what is healthy, and that all starts with, knowing how to read a label and knowing, how to stay away from high sugar, high carb type diets. And I think when we start with that and get educating yourself, then you can take it from there and kind of figure out what you like to eat and what you can stick to. And that's a key thing as well.
What issues were you seeing in Los Angeles where you were campaigning to change foods available to kids?
Yeah, so that was one of my previous businesses was to focus on taking out all the unhealthy vending machines in the school districts in LAUSD, which is the second largest school district in the country. And what we were seeing there was that, 80-some percent of students actually eat their lunch from vending machines and or go off campus and eat pizza and McDonald's and things like that. And as a result, very few actually eat a healthy diet. And so with the exception of athletes and people who are, very cognizant of eating healthy, the majority of students were pretty unhealthy. And so the focus there was taking out sugary drinks such as sodas and replacing them with more waters and juices and really just kind of educating, but most importantly, just making it a cool thing to do, making it cool to eat healthy. And that was a real change agent for us.
You also saw in your own family and in your own community some serious health challenges. What were those that just made you decide to both change your life and try to change the life of those around you?
Oh, excellent question. I actually grew up in Washington, D.C., and now live, in California and in Southern California. But the majority of my family is actually from Louisiana, Baton Rouge and New Orleans. So kind of middle of the country folks, we love to party. We love to eat well. And, all that kind of catches up with you, eating a lot of fried foods, drinking a lot every single day of the week. and, you know, just kind of eating a lot of fast food. And so in my family in particular, you know, I had three people who've had, you know, full-blown type 2 diabetes in the last couple of years who've actually had to have limbs amputated, you know, people in their 50s and not even 60. And so I started to realize that, you know, I'm on the younger side. I'm in my 40s, but there's something called pre-diabetes. According to the American Diabetes Association, 85 million people are what's called pre-diabetic, which means they don't actually have a disease, but because of their obesity and because of their eating habits, if they continue to do what they're doing, they will have type 2 diabetes. And I was shocked to find, and I think hopefully it's common knowledge now, that you can actually reverse pre-diabetes and in some cases type 2 diabetes with just diet and lifestyle changes. And so for me, that's been a mission of our company, NatureAid, and our product Vegan Smart, to give people the option to reverse those conditions through just a healthy diet. And so that's what we're all about.
Well, let's talk about some of kind of the principles of a healthy diet. What are some of the first things that people might want to look at, looking at how they're eating now and how they might want to eat?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there's some obvious things, you know, that I see. One is just, you know, cutting out bread, cutting out added sugars to your diet. And if anything, just really having some way you measure that. So it's easily put as, you know, you want to burn more calories than you take in. So that's the number one thing, is to start measuring what you're doing. I think number two is to, you know, find two things that you do that, you know, add a lot of sugar, add a lot of carbohydrates into your diet, and look to figure out ways to substitute that, if not with other foods to eat, maybe other activities or other things you do in replace of that. So I would simply say, you know, for me, and I recommend this to everyone, is, you know, cutting down on alcohol during the week, for example, and as well as cutting out bread and rice out of your diet, or at least during the week, and you'll see a noticeable opportunity right there to increase your health. And I think the other kind of simple thing is just drink a half a gallon of water a day, as well as eat vegetables, fruits and vegetables. Pick them first to put on your plate. And then the second thing, and then after you do that, I think you can get into the specifics of which kind of diet works for you and things like that.
So I'm going to back up a little bit, Claude, and I'm afraid that you might have lost a whole lot of people when you said cut out bread, because bread is, right, you know, it is so popular and common, and you know, we reach for it pretty much without thinking. I mean, you know, a sandwich for lunch. So right, maybe talk a little bit about why cutting things out, or cutting down on things like bread and rice and other carbohydrates like that, why that's something that you promote.
Yeah, we promote that just because those are things that you mindlessly do that add a lot of sugar and stored fat to your body. And you know, I think just practically speaking, without getting too technical one way or the other, is that, first of all, I mean, there's a lot of great foods that you actually like the taste of absent the bread. You know, so if you like a grilled chicken sandwich, some people are just as easily to like the grilled chicken with vegetables and something else, you know. You know, so I think, and then the second thing relative to the alcohol is that, when you drink a lot, it leads you to make poor dietary decisions. And so my goal is to you know, inform people that, hey, not to not have alcohol or not have bread, but view them as desserts. Because when you really look at the nutritional value of, like, bread, for example, in many cases it's almost the exact same thing as eating a candy bar. So, you know, if there's ways for you to say, hey, I can have my bread, but I'll do it on the weekend, or I can have, you know, a few slices of pizza, but I'm going to do it on the weekend as opposed to during the week. You say, hey, during the week, I'm going to eat clean. I'm going to eat, you know, grilled fish, or I'm going to eat, you know, a shrimp fajita without the bread, or a chicken fajita. There's ways to get that taste in through things you already eat and just kind of push the things that don't really taste like anything, like rice doesn't really taste like anything or bread doesn't really taste like anything, move those things to the weekend just kind of as a treat for yourself. But understand that in many cases they're just as caloric as, you know, as candy bars and things that you consider dessert.
I have to say, Claude, I have actually cut back a lot on carbs because of a concern about prediabetes. And you're right. They really are kind of filler. The only thing I really miss is when you've got something that's got a really good sauce to it and there's nothing to soak it up. That's the only thing that when I really miss it.
And you know what? I think it's all about balance. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's a new year. It's a chance to have a new you. And, you know, what we want to focus on, I know everyone in our industry, as well as health professionals, want to focus on is saying, hey, look, you know, it's all about finding a way to live that's sustainable for you, that long term and that you can have fun with. No one wants to just kind of, you know, not be able to have any fun with their food or not be able to go out with friends and do their thing. So I think it's definitely all about moderation. But I think it's about having a plan about how you eat and really just looking at what are the one or two things that you do that, you know, that you may not be aware of that really add to that waistline. And if you could just find one or two things to say no to and find ways to say yes to everything else, then you're well on your way in terms of just getting the fundamentals right. And I think that's kind of the key.
We're talking with Claude Tellis. He's an entrepreneur whose work focuses on healthy eating, especially in low-income communities. And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234 or by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Have you managed to eat healthy on a budget? Are you struggling with it and maybe looking for some advice? Are you trying to find ways to get your family on board with eating healthy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation with Claude after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Claude Tellis. He's an entrepreneur whose work focuses on healthy eating, especially in underprivileged communities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Are you looking for ways to stay healthy on a budget? Maybe you've successfully done that and have some tips to share. Or tell us if you're trying to encourage healthy eating on a community level. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Claude, I want to back up a little bit and talk about some of the health disparities that have affected African American communities. You talked a little bit about the experience in your family, but the statistics community-wide is really shocking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when you start with just type 2 diabetes, you know, high blood pressure and cardiovascular diseases, I mean, those by themselves are major killers in the African-American community and all people of color, as well as just really people in the middle of the country as well, who tend to have similar kind of diets. And with those kind of disparities, you know, it all leads us to taking high blood pressure medicine and being on insulin and doing these different things. And the reality is that most of that is completely reversible with, you know, the proper diet. And so the question just becomes, you know, how can you incorporate the right diet to reverse those kinds of conditions? And a lot of it becomes, you know, a high protein, low sugar, moderate fat type diet. And the issue for us is just most of us are just very culturally unaware of how we, the foods that we eat and we grew up on and things like that are contributing. And so we have to take a look at that and try to correct it.
It seems like there are so many different elements that kind of have to fall in place for change to be made and to be made successfully. I mean, people need to understand what healthy eating is about, and I know that that's been part of your mission, is really educating people on what healthy eating looks like. But then there's also access to healthy foods, and that both means places to buy them, but also the money to afford them. And so how do you kind of take that step by step and help people get to where they need to get to?
Well, I mean, you know, with our company, I'll just start there and make it broader than that. But with our company, you know, we have a product called Vegan Smart, which is, you know, a meal replacement that, you know, costs $25 for, you know, about 15 servings. So you're talking about, you know, a couple dollars per meal, so to speak. And that product, it's high protein, 20 grams of protein, but only 5 grams of sugar. And it's made for breakfast so that you blend it up with blueberries, strawberries, raspberries. And our thing is that it tastes better than a biscuit at McDonald's or than a donut or than a bagel. And so starting with us, I'd say, you know, it's about having something like that. It's very simple to do. You don't have to use our brand. There's a number of great brands out there, but we think we're one of the best tasting and one of the cleanest. But having a smoothie for breakfast instead of, you know, going to McDonald's or grabbing that donut or bagel, that's a great start. So it's simple things that you can do. In terms of the accessibility, you know, with our company, we sell our product on a subscription model. So if you want to vegansmart.com, you can get 2 free samples, and then you can actually, you know, buy a jug for, you know, $50 a month, which breaks down to a couple dollars per meal. There's a number of other companies that have that kind of a program as well. And then with the reach of Amazon now, having bought Whole Foods, you can go onto Amazon and find, obviously you can find our product, Vegan Smart, but you can find a number of other products as well. So I think it's about going online, being aware of these different subscription models and things like that. That will kill the access problem. And also I'd say about our product is that we're actually available in 1,800 Walmarts. So we're one of the only products that is available in Whole Foods as well as in Walmart. And so at a very reasonable price, $2 a meal. And so when you look at it like that, there are companies like ours that are making that step towards being a clean product, being affordable, and being accessible. And like I say, we're not the only ones. There's on Amazon, you can order, you know, frozen strawberries, frozen blueberries, all kinds of fresh produce that can come to your house within a couple hours if you're on Prime. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of ways to really you know, beat that accessibility issue.
Well, and Claude, I want to talk about other than the types of products you're talking about, when people are going to the grocery store and buying food to make for themselves and their family, how should they be thinking about their plates? How should they be, you know, thinking about vegetables and proteins and maybe some carbs, even if it's less than they would normally be eating?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think it's the, you know, there's a very interesting movie that just came out on Netflix called What the Health, and they just talk about just how much meat everyone is eating, and that it's become 80% of the plate and only 20% are veggies. I would challenge everyone to reverse that. Make it 80% veggies and 20% meat. You know, so I think when you go to the grocery store, you know, you're looking for your kale. You're looking for all kind of different vegetables. The more color, the better. So you want, you know, your red peppers and your green peppers and cucumbers. Just anything that's fresh and easy that you can get into your diet, and have some fun with it. You know, use the same seasonings and garlic powders and hot sauce to get that jalapenos, to get that good taste. So it's not just boring and bland. So I would say to spend time in the produce as well as in the seasoning section to make sure that those veggies are going to taste good and going to be 80% of your plate. And then while I'm reducing significantly the meat that I eat after watching some of these documentaries and studying a bit, but I still think that, you know, having salmon, blackened fish, different kinds of fish are always light and digest easily. And even if you want to still stay with some red meats here or there, You know, never killed anybody, but it's just a matter of making it a much smaller percentage of what's on your plate.
Let's go to the phone, and Ray in Rhinelander is up. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I'm a senior citizen, retired. I'm on a set income, and I eat organic, pretty much about 80%, 90%. And less is more. What that means is I can only buy less, but the quality that I'm getting is so much better. I was 250 pounds. I went down to 190 pounds just on diet. And another key thing, people, exercise. When you exercise, your whole body and metabolism changes, and you don't crave the foods that make you fat. I mean, that's a given. It's scientifically proven. And I know organic is more, but there's a lot of big chains that carry organic. You eat less, but you get more. And it works. And that's what I wanted to contribute.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ray. Some good points there. And certainly, Claude, even if you're spending more to buy organic produce, if that's instead of going out to eat, you're still spending less on that meal.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, as he said, I mean, you know, just diet is 80% of losing weight. It's only 20% exercise, but they go hand in hand. And they really, you know, you really need to do them together. But people don't really realize you can't exercise your way out of a bad diet. So if the reverse is true, meaning that, hey, you're like, hey, I just want to keep eating what I eat, and I'm going to exercise, that's why I exercise. Well, that doesn't work. It's really about 80% diet. And as he said, there's a lot of ways to get organic produce and organic products now online through Amazon and other companies as well.
Thanks for that call, Ray. And Claude, you know, we started out talking about vending machines, and many workplaces and schools still have conventional vending machine foods. What are some healthier snack options for people who might be needing to use that from time to time?
Yeah, I think, you know, honestly, there's a lot of great products out there these days. You know, you've got Quest bars that are in a lot of vending machines. They're also in 7-Elevens. You know, you have Kind bars that are, you know, kind of more granola type products, but two that are very focused on having a lot less sugar in them. You do have to be very careful about what's in vending machines, as well as some of the things I just mentioned, granola bars and power bars and things like that, because some, you know, have just as much sugar as in like a candy bar. So you have to be, you know, really careful about that. Nothing is better than just eating a piece of fruit and or you know, planning ahead and trying to eat the healthiest thing you can at home. So
and or maybe bringing a little bag of nuts or something to have on hand so you don't get too hungry.
Exactly. So it's out there. You have to plan, but hey, you know, it's your health, it's your life, and you know, like you said earlier, it's so easy to there's definitely ways to reverse type 2 diabetes and these others through our own diet, but you do have to learn, you know, what's out there and make the change.
Well, Claude, thanks so much for spending the time with us, and happy 2018.
Hey, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. Please send everyone to vegansmart.com. We're, you know, giving away two free samples.
Okay, we're going to have to cut it there. Claude Tellis is a CEO of NatureAid, which makes Vegan Smart a vegan nutritional protein powder. He joined us to talk about healthy eating and the changes he's helped make in underprivileged communities. American Girl dolls have deep Wisconsin roots, and fans wait anxiously to learn who the next American Girl doll will be. Well, the 2018 character has been announced, and she is Luciana Vega, an 11-year-old girl of Chilean descent who is an aspiring astronaut and dreams of being the first person to go to Mars. Her storyline includes time spent at space camp in Huntsville, Alabama, and being a youth astronaut trainee. American Girl wanted to be sure to get all the details right, so they formed an advisory advisory board of four experts, a former NASA chief scientist, the CEO and executive director of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, a NASA astronaut, and the manager of strategic alliances at NASA. And, by the way, those are all women. NASA, Scholastic Books, and Space Camp are also teaming up with American Girl to fund STEM-based educational programs and materials for 3rd to 5th grade boys and girls nationwide. Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll find out how emissions from barrel recycling plants in the Milwaukee area are impacting the lives of nearby residents. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.